I was left with either raise capital and start my portfolio or wait for another 5 years and try to get into the market. And I knew I didn't have that kind of time.
Are you a real estate investor looking to sharpen your skills or a newbie looking to become one? You're in the right place. Welcome to Where Should I Invest? Real Estate Investing in Canada with your host, Sarah Larby.
Hey guys, it is Sarah Larby here, and we are back for another episode of Where Should I Invest? Today's guest is Sarah Etter, and Sarah Etter is actually a very good friend of mine. We've done a flip together last year that I ended up burring and bought her out, but we were partners in a Brantford house that we took down to the studs pretty much. And the intention originally was to flip, but as you guys know, I love holding on to my properties, so we worked out a deal and I decided to keep it. So Sarah, though, is very, very talented, very good at finding private money. And with this deal that we've been able to do, and this actually is going back about a year ago, we were able to get 100% of the loan of what the house was purchased for, pretty much. So it was bought for $220,000. And the private lender gave us $218,000 at 10%, which if you're doing a flip and it's short-term money, it is actually pretty reasonable. So she is able to really find money. And one of the things that we all run out of at some point is money and financing, but it's also money. And so Sarah really is probably one of the most talented people I know at finding private lenders and making deals happen and all that good stuff. And she is a young millennial, she's a woman, and she's got a great, great story as well. So I'm really, really excited to have her on the show. And she also was the co-host on a couple of these episodes, as you guys will see in the next few weeks. She was helping me co-host, and we've had a lot of fun. So you can meet Sarah if you do come out to the Right Club, if you are a Right Club attendee. She's going to be speaking in May, and she is a regular attendee as well. So anyways, guys, I'm really excited about this episode. Let me know what you think. And if you don't mind, feel free to leave a rating and review. All right, well, let's get on with the interview. All right, so today we have Sarah Etter, and Sarah and I know each other probably for about a year and a half now from the Right Club. And I wanted to bring Sarah on today because Sarah is a millennial like myself who is very, very successful and has raised a lot of money. So for you guys that are thinking, how do I even get started? I don't really even have any money to get started. I thought we would bring Sarah in and she can share her tips and insights. So welcome, Sarah.
Awesome. Hey guys, happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. So before we really start digging into raising capital, how did you get started in real estate investing to begin with?
Yeah. Well, I actually love telling this story because it's so unconventional. I was actually a professional athlete by trade. I've been training my entire life, 15 years of my life. That's all I knew. It's all I ever wanted to do. And I got to a point in my late 20s where my business was struggling. I realized there was no way I was going to make money. I'd met my long-term partner. I started to seriously think about settling down, having kids. And I thought, oh boy, I'm down some interesting road right now. I had so much debt. Like I said, my business was really, really struggling. And I thought, okay, this is not the way I'm going to have a stable life. And thank God, before I embarked on my athletic career, my parents made me get a bachelor's in business and finance. So I've always been good with numbers. I have a background in business. And I thought, okay, I'm going to test the waters. I'm going to get just a contract part-time job in the corporate world, see how I like it. And that'll be my decision. Either I stay in the corporate world or I go back to my athletic career. Mm-hmm. And I just so happened to take on a contract admin role with a property management company. And the fellow that owned the company happened to be just an average guy like us who quit his own job. He was an engineer. He had joint venture partners. He grew this entire portfolio, 150 doors from scratch in a few years. And I was so inspired. I was so impressed at what this guy was able to accomplish. I thought, okay, forget whatever I'm doing. We're here. Let this business go. I sold off all my assets and just dove right in. I asked him to teach me and mentor me. I asked him to take me on full time, and actually ended up becoming kind of more of a director of operations of the company. And here we are today.
So you were managing, I guess, with him 150 doors. So you definitely learned all about the landlord and tenant rules and regulations.
Too much. Yeah.
You have some horror stories.
Yeah. If there's anything I learned, it was about inheriting tenants. People make it seem like when you buy a property and a tenant is on like a month-to-month contract, that it's really easy to get them out. And it's not. The books, they lie. It's not simple. The landlord-tenant board in Ontario is so strict. And those inherited tenants were the worst. We usually had to go right through the process of like the sheriff eviction with them. And it was terrible.
So despite all of that, you still said, I'm going to keep going and I still buy real estate. And
yeah, well, I did all the accounting, like a lot of the bookkeeping, and I saw the rent roll every month. So it made sense to me.
Okay. So how long ago was that now?
That would be almost actually 2 years this November that I first started. And I stuck there for about a year and I just gave it my all. Learned so much. I joined a bunch of networking groups. I mean, really, really dove in my education, and then decided after a year it was time to kind of branch off and do my own portfolio. So yeah.
Cool. Very cool. So a lot of what you focus on is raising capital, and talk to us about how that even comes about. How did you raise capital? How did you find the people to raise capital, and what did you buy?
Yeah, it was an interesting journey for me. It was great that I didn't just work for any property management company. He himself was a master at joint ventures, and otherwise I would have never known. Because I had to get rid of my company, I was in severe debt. I was an entrepreneur for 6 years. I was, and still, a terrible mortgage candidate. So I was like, okay, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And I have no choice. Like I was left with either raise capital and start my portfolio or wait for another 5 years and try to get into the market. And I knew I didn't have that kind of time. Right. So I read every book, every seminar. I took training camps, like everything there was, just to teach myself how. And I started out simple. Friends and family, extended family, friends of friends of friends and colleagues. And just, it was kind of sheer luck at first. You think at first it's easy. I got a lot of no's. People were like, you don't really know what you're doing. And I got my first one, which was a friend of the family. And he kind of had a relationship where he knew of me. And he took a chance on me. And we actually ended up investing in a student condo rental in Waterloo. And that's how I kind of got into student rentals. And from there, I started to acquire kind of like a handful. I did a few in Guelph, one in Brantford. And then it just kind of snowballed from there. I got more confidence. Like I got better at it. I made a lot of mistakes in the beginning. But yeah.
So you were the active partner. So you were managing a lot of these deals with your experience as well that you had in the past with a property management company. Yeah. And so they were strictly the money partner. Now, how did you structure the deals? Like, were they loaning 100% loan to value each time, or how did that work?
Those student rentals were very, very straightforward. They were people that had good T4s, corporate jobs, just not a lot of time. So it was really textbook, which I was fortunate. So it was just clean 50-50. They put down the capital, the mortgage financing, and I just came in and tenanted and managed it. We split equity, cash flow 50-50. The one deal was actually interesting. It was my first kind of like VTB. The guy already owned the property. He was thinking of selling it. This is a student rental in Brantford. But because he already owned it and had some good equity, he was like, hey, why don't you kind of like find a way to buy in, and then we'll own it and kind of manage it together. So that was my first kind of VTB type experience, which is cool.
Yeah, for those of you guys that are wondering, VTB is what, Sarah?
It's a vendor take back mortgage. So it basically works like when someone has like enough equity in the house, they basically just lend you that equity as like a mortgage without the financing. So for a joint venture, it works great because they don't have to worry about selling the property and I get to buy in for basically nothing. So
okay, very cool. And so what's your exit strategy on something like that?
It depends. I mean, I ideally want to hold it for as long as possible, but I usually try to chunk it up in like 5-year spans for when the mortgage expires. That's at least a point where we can reevaluate what's happening in the market, where my particular investor is in terms of their life. Some of them have kids, they're going off to college. Sometimes they need money, they need cash. And so we might decide at that time to sell, decide to just refinance and hold it. And then kind of the third would be, if I really want to keep it, I can always find or try to find another equity partner to kind of buy in their share and try to keep holding the property. So there's usually a few different options.
Okay. All right. Very cool. Now, these money partners, when you're saying like you're asking your friends, you're asking your family, and somebody's going to give you a chance, I think this is good for everybody to hear, because at some point, even if you haven't done a deal yet, you ask enough people or you find a great deal and the money can come to you. It's not impossible.
Exactly. Absolutely. And if you don't have a track record, your friends and family are your best bet. Or even, like I said, like the friends of like family friends, people that those kind of referral style things where they're willing to give you a shot. That's usually a good way to start.
Okay. So let's fast forward to these days now. How are you looking for money?
Yeah.
And how are you now structuring the deals? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So things are pretty complicated now. I've kind of advanced to the upper level of JV investing, where it's not just 50-50 anymore, where someone brings some capital and a mortgage, you buy a little single family home and life's great. It's let's buy a 26 unit building and we need to find 7 investors with private capital, and some want equity, some want interest. It gets like, I do a lot of different stuff now. I still do my traditional 50-50s, but we're doing a lot of like duplex conversions, which at those, sometimes I use up to like 3 different JVs at a time. I might use 1 for the down payment and a second mortgage, 1 for mortgage financing, and then a 3rd one at the end to take over as equity partner during the refi process. So it gets messy. I really don't recommend that if you're first starting that you like work with multiple JVs, but at some point, if you want to accelerate your portfolio, sometimes it's just necessary. You just can't find all the equity or capital in one deal. So that's kind of where I'm at now, is just pooling together a bunch of different things to kind of accelerate. So
nowadays, if somebody wants to look and maybe they don't have family or friends that are really going to be able to help them, like how else can they find these money lenders?
Resorting more and more to like online. Cause I think like once you kind of exhaust the friends and family route, you can only see them face to face so much. I would say like 50% of my leads come from networking events and the other 50% are coming from social media. And I think like being millennials as we are, like we can't deny that having a brand, having a presence online is so powerful. And if you do it correctly, I'm finding tremendous success. People are finding me through YouTube and reaching out, Instagram, all these different avenues. I'm very, very active. That's been my goal probably for the past 6 months. I've really made a huge effort to post on social media every day, put out videos every week, and I'm really, really finding a lot of success with that now.
Where should I invest? With your host, Sarah Larvey. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick moment and pause the podcast interview here because I wanted to introduce you to Dahlia Barsoom of Streetwise Mortgages. I am a big believer, as you guys probably have heard, work with a mortgage broker. They are going to help you scale. And when I was first growing in real estate investing and looking to buying my second property and my third property, I was going directly to the bank then. I hadn't met Dahlia yet. And I actually was hitting a roadblock when it came to financing because the bank started asking me for 25% as the down payment. And then for my third property, they wanted 35%. And it was really, really hard for me to A, understand why it was creeping up like that. And B, I didn't have 35% to put down. I had 20%. And luckily, I actually met Dahlia at that point in time. And Dahlia is actually an investor herself, and she works with many, many investors. And she knows all the pitfalls and the barriers that normally come up with dealing directly with a bank and all the different lenders. And Dahlia was actually able to not just find me proper alternatives, but I've got 9 properties now and I'm still able to get financing with A lenders, and it allows me to be able to scale up without hitting the financing wall. And so she's been a tremendous help. So the other thing I really, really enjoy is Dahlia also does a free goals analysis. So if you go to either my website or her website, streetwisemortgages.com, mention the podcast and ask for the free goals analysis, it was a game changer for me. And it allowed me to actually understand what I needed to do, how many properties I was going to get because of the cash flow that I was looking for. If you guys wanted to reach out to Dahlia, you can reach out to her by email, which is info@streetwisemortgages.com, or you can actually reach out to her on the website at streetwisemortgages.com and then just go to the contact section. And you can also call her at 1-800-208-6255. Thanks for listening, and back to the show.
Back to the show. Where should I invest? Real estate investing in Canada with your host, Sarah Larvey.
So is it fair to say that you've raised about $1 million? Is that roughly the number this year?
Yeah, as of I think October, I raised about $1.2 million and still actually going up till Christmas. I had so many investor meetings last week. People are really starting to crunch down now before for the new year. So yeah, it probably might even be closer to 1.5 by the end of the year.
So do you think it's easier to find money or find somebody that's willing to hold a mortgage or both?
That's such an interesting question. I get that a lot from like my coaching clients. I would say it all depends on the climate of what's happening with the lending, like what's happening with the government, things like that. I think before it was easier to find that traditional 50-50. I'm finding personally now, capital is no issue. I almost have too much capital. And what I'm lacking are people that can qualify for mortgages. And people are getting scared now of the lending regulations, tightening stress tests. Mm-hmm. And to convince someone to put their name on a mortgage title now is actually really difficult. Or even just finding people that can qualify like at a certain level.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the same thing. I think the money is going to be there, but again, the financing piece is the more difficult piece to find. So if you guys can find somebody that's willing to hold the mortgage and also put the money down, then that's great. But like you said, I think a lot of people are more money lenders and they don't want to use one of their limited slots.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why, like, I'm putting together almost like I call them like my puzzle piece JVs. It's like I'm having to find people that can like only hold a mortgage or only put down capital. And I'm having to kind of like mash them together to like make the deals work now because it's just so hard to find both.
So do you split, do you do 25% then for the money partner and then 25% for the mortgage holder, or how does that work?
It depends on my money lenders. I actually have, I would say like I'm blessed with the private money lenders that I have because they're not through brokers. They're just personal relationships I've built. So like no lending fees. And most of the time they don't want equity. They just want monthly interest. So if I can make my reno budget in like a basement conversion float, like that overhead cost to give them that monthly interest, then I don't have to give them a cent of equity, which is awesome. So I try to make it work.
Yeah, like a flat amount is always great. I mean, so Sarah and I did a deal this summer, which I ended up keeping and renting and paid out Sarah. And you were able to bring in the money partner. So do you want to briefly talk about that?
Yeah. So that was actually one of my first money partners, the Brantford student rental that I told you about. I found him through like a private open house through Kijiji, which is cool. He was actually liquidating his last property, was just going to go retire in Florida. I told him who I was and he was like, hey, you know, I have some private money. Maybe we should do some deals together. So lo and behold, we've been investing together almost like 2 years and he's one of the best private lenders you could find. When I first started to talk to Sarah about doing this, I had all this private money, but I didn't have a renovation budget. And I also am a really conservative investor. So I didn't want to partner up with someone who couldn't hold a mortgage as well as a possible exit strategy. So Sarah and I started talking and it was perfect because she was able to hold a mortgage if possible, which was what ended up happening. She loves Brantford, is where she invests. So it was kind of like a win for both of us. And I was able to bring on private money at 100% loan to value, no fees besides his lawyer's fees, which were not that expensive. And he wired the money like that. We closed on the property and it was actually a pretty seamless process. So it's an example of when things go right and you have really easygoing money lenders.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's the thing that people also have to factor in, because you can go to your mortgage broker. If you've got a good mortgage broker, they probably know private lenders. But you want to also understand not just the rates someone's lending money, but also what fees are involved. So if you've ever heard the term points, mm-hmm. 1.2 point, that's an example. So an example of that is if you have a $100,000 mortgage loan, you're paying, and 1 point means you're paying $1,000 on $100K upfront before anything, mm-hmm. before any other payment, 2 points, 2,000, et cetera, et cetera. And so those are some fees. Of course, there are going to be some other fees like lawyer fees on the back end, on the front end, and some other things to consider. And so before you accept somebody's money, just understand really the true cost of it is what I would say.
That's an amazing point. And that's why people always say, oh, that's great, you have private money. And I'm like, no, you don't understand my private money. I've already negotiated against all those extra fees. So I know when I buy a property, I pay their lawyer costs and then that's it. I can go in and put an offer on the property. So it's really straightforward, which is great.
That's good. So let's just talk about like what your private money partners, for example, want from you in terms of communication. Or so let's just say, okay, let's just say I have money and I say, okay, Sarah, well, I'm going to loan you $100,000 at 10%. So you have the money available. What's next for you? Like, what do you do then?
That's a great question. And it's something like I really like coach people that like your deal is not done. Like once you get the money, that's actually the time when like you need to communicate more than ever, especially if you want to do like repeat deals. If you want to like get referrals from these people, you have to treat them like gold. Like, you have to communicate with them. And I think it's just like being upfront with them in the very beginning, like before you even set up the deal, you need to ask them like, how often do I need to check in with you? How much do you really want to know? Because I have some money partners, like my guy that Sarah and I worked with, like he doesn't care. As long as he's getting his money every month, like he never checks in, like the odd time, like he'll kind of say like, hey, how's it going? But for the most part, he doesn't care. But I have another money lender who like, she likes to come to the projects, like check in. She kind of texts me every week, wants a phone call and a follow-up. So I think it's just being really transparent ahead of time and getting to know your lender and like what their preferences are. But even so, I try to over deliver, like at least once a week, every couple of weeks, I'm giving them at least an email update, a quick phone call. If it's a long-term buy and hold, I do proper quarterly reports, like PDFs with like the cash flow analysis and a letter and updates on the tenants and things like that. I think that goes a long way in like establishing your professionalism and really showing like you know what you're doing. So
absolutely. So for you, like, is there anything that as you're doing these money lenders, anything that you've learned that you're like, hey, I made this mistake in the beginning, but I've learned from that. And this is a typical mistake a lot of people make, or did it? Yeah.
I'm like, there's so many mistakes because it's easy to get like so excited, like your uncle or like your uncle's best friend, like it's like, hey, I want to give you a couple $100,000. You're just like, okay, awesome. Like, let me go find a property. And it's like, just reason goes out of your head. So I learned that number one, the biggest mistake I made in the beginning was not getting them to sign something on paper before we did a deal. So, because it's easy for someone to say, yeah, okay, I want to invest with you. But if you don't get them to sign like some sort of commitment letter or something like that, when it actually comes time to put the money down, it's incredible the amount of people with cold feet and like flakiness. Like your lender just all of a sudden doesn't call you back and you're thinking like, wait, I talked to him 2 days ago. He was down. Why is he answering me?
Right.
So that's one thing. It's like, I do too many deals to have that type of stress. So I make them sign like either a commitment letter, a letter of intent, a promissory note, like something ahead of time that says like, hey, you are promising these funds X amount on this date. I have them. If I put in an offer, you're committed. Otherwise, like it's such a headache. It can be a nightmare. So I would say that was definitely like my biggest mistake in the beginning.
Yeah, no, definitely some good advice there. Now, so you find the money first, it sounds like, and then you go out and you look for the deal based on your conversation that you've had with them.
I do things like backwards. Like I would say it's kind of like the difference between like a client first rent to own and like a house first, like rent to own. Some people like to do it either way. I find that just like in doing like a deal first rent to own, it's really hard to get someone committed to a deal that you're putting in front of them that they didn't have like an investment in. Right? Like they might get excited about it, but it's like not their deal. So I find if I can close them on me as a person, my business, my strategy, then I can get them to sign that commitment letter, say, okay, now that I understand your needs, exactly what you want, let me go find like the perfect property for you. And then you get to decide. And then I'll give them like 3 or 4 different deals. They get to pick. And then they have that like extra level of like investment. Like they're like, yeah, this is my deal. I like it. I want it. So it seems for me, at least, it works a lot better.
Okay, cool. So is there a case where you could have a lender ready to go, but deals are hard to find, especially nowadays, that you find anything for 6 months, 9 months, a year? Like, how do you keep them warm?
So this is actually something that I'm struggling with the moment. I've never had so much capital all at one time sitting around and the market's slow. Like, we're heading into Christmas. I have like my investors saying, hey, what's happening? Like, we want some deals. And I've considered creating like a trust where I will start to like pool their money and pay them interest, because at the end of the day, their money is very valuable to me because of how easy it is to come by, like the lack of bank fees, all that kind of stuff. So I'm definitely considering something like that. Cause like you said, like that's the biggest struggle with anyone that does JVs is finding enough deals for these people to stay interested. So you have to kind of find incentives. Like even if it's like, hey, I'll pay you like $500 a month just to keep your money like on tap. Give me another month. Give me some extra time to find a deal. I'd say do it. It might be a bit of money out of pocket, but in the long run, it's going to pay off. So
let's talk about finding deals, because I know you hinted at it a couple times and it's definitely not as easy. This is why I say to somebody, I'm like, don't worry so much about the money, like find the deal. And trust me, like things will network enough and come to enough networking events. And at some point you'll have people that are ready to go. Yeah. And so what are you doing to find deals right now?
I have like literally flooded resources. I am friends with every wholesaler I can possibly get like a number for. I have made friends with multiple realtors in all the different markets that I'm in. I'm friends with other investors who would be willing to maybe give me pocket listings. Like I even do my own mailers now. Not that I'm like super interested in wholesaling, but hey, if it gets me a lead on a private deal, awesome. Like I'm every avenue I can find I'm using, because it's tough out there right now in the GTA. Like it's really tough, especially because I'm looking for such specific deals. I'm either looking for flips, student rentals, basement conversions, or multifamilies. I would say those are probably the toughest deals to find.
Yeah. And the flips now too, like even the flips that are on the market, you really have to run the numbers over and over. And there's always a good time to do a flip. But I would just say, like, always have an exit strategy for anything that it is. Because if your flip, the market takes a turn, or rates keep going up, or all of a sudden, I don't know, whatever happens, it's really timed by the market day to day, unfortunately. While long-term holds or multifamily, like when you have a five-year out time span, like you have time to take on a little bit more of the waves.
Oh, 100%. Like I sleep well at night because I know that like I have, for example, like enough private money that were a deal to sink, I could just like probably buy them out with like a private mortgage. It might be at 6 or 8%, but at least like I like would know that the initial investor's money is cashed out, or I have enough people that can hold mortgages for me at even temporarily. I'm even like a 1-year mortgage, anything, right? When it comes to a flip, can help. I, like you said, I think that's so important, unless you literally want to be up every day at night wondering, oh God, what's the market going to do? I couldn't handle doing that. So I make sure I have like multiple ways that I could even just buy the house for cash if I had to get my investors' money back.
Awesome. Yeah, that's important because like you said, it's referrals and it's your brand and your reputation. They're number one.
I always tell them, and it's one of my, I would say, selling features, is that I tell them like, listen, like we can hold this property for 5 years, and if it makes zero profit, I'm going to make zero. You're getting your money back. I like whatever I have to do, you will get your money back, even if I make like not a cent on the deal. And that's enough usually to keep them confident that I'm really like valuing their money first. So
what kind of agreements on the back end do you do with your JVs?
Usually just like a standard joint venture agreement. Most of my JVs are pretty conservative, so they usually want to be on title, or at least have be on the mortgage. Like they have something on a piece of paper beyond just the JV. And that's just how mine work. And I totally get it in this market, especially when we're doing flip. I get wanting to be on title if something goes wrong, that they want to have an actual attachment to that bricks and mortar. And then just like I do a pretty standard JV that I've used again and again. I mean, I could do a whole episode on probably what my JV agreement looks like. I have a bunch of templates.
If you guys have any more questions, I guess reach out to Sarah. We'll have at the end that you can mention.
So
let's just say a little bit of experience, maybe not too much, and I have a good deal, but I don't have the capital. And so are you, or are your money partners, like, is there any addition to a third person that comes in with a deal? Like, have you done that? And how would that look like?
I'm actually doing that a lot lately, which is pretty cool. Mostly because I'm running out of time. Like you said, finding the deal, it's so complicated. It's so hard that I found I was spinning my wheels trying to find enough deals to satisfy all my money partners. So I thought to myself, why not leverage my time, focus on what I'm good at, which is finding money, and just start to partner with people who are, like you said, like investors with a bit of experience who do specific things in specific markets. Mm-hmm. And what I do now is I bring in the money. Mostly my money lenders don't even want equity. So we're just making sure that it can float their monthly interest. And then I come in, negotiate a chunk of equity or profit with that particular investor. And then everyone's happy. So it's actually kind of an interesting model. I don't know how many people do it this way, but for me, I can do so many more deals like this. If I'm not actually finding the deal myself, all I need to do is go find some cash, throw it off to like another investor and take a piece of it, and we're all happy. So
yeah, you're just putting people together and yeah. A piece of the puzzle.
Exactly. It works great for me.
What else should somebody know about what you do or finding money? Finding money partners, piecing deals together like that. Like, is there anything else that I haven't asked you that's important to discuss?
I would say, like, if you're just getting started, to focus more on building relationships than just finding deals. I think a lot of people think that like the numbers are going to sell somebody on like capital. And I've made that mistake too, right? I've learned that it is so much more important to build that relationship. If they trust you and they like you, the deal will come. Like, find out what they like, because there's no point in pitching somebody a student rental if they want to do a rent to own. It doesn't make sense if you don't get to know them and their risk preferences or what they want for the long term, then you're just shooting in the dark. It's like wasting your time. So I would say like definitely focus on like the trust aspect and really getting to know like in depth like the needs of your investors. You'll do so much better that way.
Yeah. And then just to add to that too, like you network a lot. And so by being where other investors are continuously, I think that creates a sense of trust.
Yeah.
And people to say she's not just coming once to ask for stuff. Like she's there again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And you know, like whatever it is, like you're, it's not a fly by night type of thing. So I think that helps with the credibility piece. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, it's like why social media is so popular and successful nowadays. It's like if I'm posting every day about different deals I'm doing and clients I'm working with and projects that I have on the go, people are like, oh, okay. Like if I do this enough, they see that this isn't just some random person on the internet, like talking out of like thin air. I have like some proof. So I found that, like you said, just the more visibility, the more credibility you build over time. So
very cool. Awesome. All right. So the next part of the podcast is called the lightning round. So I'm going to ask you 5 questions. Everybody, yeah. The exact same ones. And just answer the first thing that comes to mind. You ready?
All right. Let's do it.
All right. Number one, what is your favorite real estate investing book ever?
Oh my gosh. That's so hard. I would say Rich Dad Poor Dad. It got me started.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. Number two, what about your favorite podcast?
Well, besides yours, of course, that I listen to, I would say Bigger Pocket. I love listening to their podcast.
Absolutely. That's actually how I got started too, by listening to their podcast.
Yeah, that's awesome. Especially on multifamily, because that's where the space I'm in. They have such good information.
Yeah, absolutely. Number three, favorite pastime. So what do you do for fun when you are not doing anything real estate related?
Well, I love horses, right? That's kind of where I came from. So I would say my favorite pastime is just getting out to the barn, like riding and teaching and that kind of thing.
Cool. Awesome. Number four, if you lost all your money and your assets tomorrow, how would you start again?
Oh, geez. Probably right back where I am, just starting to raise capital from scratch and just keep building up a real estate portfolio. I believe in real estate that much.
Awesome. And last question, number five, if somebody has $50,000 and they want to get started, how would you recommend that they spend it?
I would say like partner up with a friend, put together some equity and or house hack, live in it together, like buy like a little duplex or something like that, especially if they're a millennial, and just leverage. I'm all about the joint venture thing, partnering together, pool your resources and build some equity. Definitely get into a property as best as you can.
Awesome. Great. So that was our lightning round. So Sarah, where can listeners find you if they wanted to reach out and know more about you?
Right on. So I am on all the social media, mostly Facebook and Instagram. So my handle is @SarahEtterInvest. And I also have a website, which is just SarahEtter.com.
Okay. Very cool. And any last words of advice or anything else that you would like to let the listeners know?
I would just say, don't give up. I mean, I'm a millennial. I just turned 30. Again, like super crazy debt that I started in, like almost like hopeless when it came to like someone would have looked at me and laughed if I had said, yeah, I want to own a real estate portfolio. So don't let your circumstances like get you down. Like there's always, always a way to push forward if you're willing to work for it. So
amazing. Very inspiring. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for being on the show. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you at the next Write Club event.
Yeah, I can't wait. Looking forward to it.
All right. Bye, guys.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Hey, guys. Before you go, I wanted to ask you a question. What's stopping you from starting or growing your own real estate investment portfolio? I know for me, before I started, I had plenty of reasons. And at the time, they all seemed very valid. But as I started my journey, these reasons slowly fell away. And eventually, only one reason remained. What was actually stopping me was having a proven, actionable, repeatable system. I didn't have that. And the way that was going to change was by investing in myself, learning, listening, and looking for ways that worked, and also, most importantly, discovering what didn't and not making those mistakes again. Fast forward to today, I now have a proven, repeatable series of action steps that has enabled me to build my seven-figure portfolio consisting of multiple homes, and I'm able to manage that in 2 to 3 hours a month. Is that something that you would want? Well, I've actually taken all the knowledge I've accumulated and put that into a comprehensive step-by-step online program. It's called Rise, and it's a program that will help you from where you are now to where you want to be faster and with less of the headaches that I had. So it consists of all the templates and the resources that I use, plus over 40 instructional videos that you get lifetime access to for just a small one-time investment. And you know, my recommendation is to make the time now to invest in yourself and grow your portfolio to seven figures so that you can bring your retirement dreams closer. If you want some more information about Rise, just go to saralarby.com/RISE to access more details and book your spot.
Thanks so much for listening to Where Should I Invest with your host, Sarah Larby. Make sure to listen in next time. We'll catch you on the next episode of Where Should I Invest?